Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning! Show me the meaning! Show me the meaning! Meaning, meaning, meaning! Show me the meaning!
Nazi punks, fuck off! Yes.
Yeah.
What up? I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
What up, film fans? It's me, Ryan.
And we got Raymond.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
This week, we're going to be talking about the 2015, I don't even really know how to classify this, suspense, horror, claustrophobic masterpiece directed by Jeremy Saulnier, Green Room, starring Anton Yelchin, Imogen Poots, Patrick Stewart, Joe Cole, Aaliyah Shawkat, and Callum Turner, amongst a nice host of supporting individuals. And as always, we're going to go around and talk about our first impressions. What was it like the first time we saw this movie? What was it like seeing it on a repeated viewing or viewings? Let's start with Ryan, since he is chomping at the bit, apparently, because he is so excited to scream about this. So in your best Dead Kennedys, Nazi punks, fuck off, scream, yell, or not, just tell us, what was it like the first time you saw this movie and what was it like revisiting it?
Man, I love this movie. A+. I'm just going to say off the bat. This is I just love the shit out of it. And the thing I love the most about it is that I really felt like I was there, right? Very few movies, like, the stakes are real, and it feels real, and it's kind of about a world that I know, which is the punk rock part, not the white nationalist part. But being in punk rock bands and stuff growing up, like, I just kind of feel like I knew versions of these kids. And then them being put in this situation that, you know, felt very real and felt and the way that it's filmed and shot and just the way that it's the storytelling unfolds, which is just so, I don't want to say cynical, but very, I don't know, I'd call it real. Like, it just, like, people, you know, some people die, like, and it just, it's like, it, you know, it's not your average Hollywood telling of something like this where, you know, they turn into badasses and become ninjas and can fight off these Nazis all of a sudden. You know, this is kind of a very much, like you said, a claustrophobic, mainly one setting suspense film about what would you do in this situation. But it's also dealing with some pertinent themes of, you know, nationalists, white nationalists, whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff too, has these socio-political undertones that we can get into as well, while also being soaked in punk rock. So all for it. Love the movie.
All right, Raymond, what's up, bro?
This is one of my favorite movies. Just
all right.
That's all.
Love fest.
That's all I've got to say at the top of this. I think Jeremy Saulnier is one of the most exciting filmmakers working today. Blue Ruin is a wonderful film. He made a kind of underseen picture called Hold the Dark that is a Netflix original. I'd highly recommend it. It's streaming on Netflix there. Check that out if you dig his whole vibe. I'm always excited to talk about great movies, and this is a great movie.
Sweet. Yeah, first time I saw it was on the recommendation of my buddy Keir Seewert that I used to do a film podcast with back in the day. And this was his favorite film of 20, I guess it would have been 2016 because it came out, he's in the UK and I was living in Ireland at the time. And
me
so it was
too.
2016. Yeah, okay. So it was 2016 at the time. And so this was his favorite film of 2016. My favorite film of 2016 was Sing Street. And what we did on our episode was we talked about both of them. He had already seen Sing Street, but I hadn't seen Green Room. So I watched it and then I got to listen to him gush about it for about an hour and 20 minutes or something like that. And so for me, that will always be like part of my memory of this film is also the joy that my friends who have great taste in movies that they kind of expressed about how great this movie was. So when I think of Green Room, I don't just think of Green Room. I also think of my friends who are like, this movie fucking rocks, right? So
those sick fucks.
Well, but it's so great because what the whole film, one of the themes of the film is that Anton Yelchin goes on this whole big like speech about how music is about live, right? You watch it, it's the moment, it's there, and then it's gone. And for me, there's something about this film that kind of also does that, you know? Like, obviously it's in digital form and you can watch it on repeat and things like that, but there's also something about it just being a sort of act of theatrical performance and presentation. And I think the film tries to do that as best as possible. So for me, that was like the first thing that I noticed about this film. The energy, the fact that it seems like a DIY kind of film, even though it's obviously got a budget and there's a production team, blah, blah, blah. But it kind of has this kind of like DIY ethic about it in the way that it's messy and frenetic. And for me, that was the thing that I loved the most.
Intense.
Yeah, it is. It's so intense. And then on this viewing, the thing that actually caught my attention the most was also some of the beauty of it, which I hadn't realized before. So you have like this contradiction between fucking Nazi punks fuck off, which is the first song they play in front of these neo-Nazi skinheads, and the crowd is like spitting at them. And then you get this really lovely sort of like almost balletic orchestral dance where these like these skinheads are headbanging in this mosh pit, you know, to this music, but there's this orchestral music behind it, and there's something beautiful about it as well. And I think there's lots of cool stuff that we can talk about with how this film is made, and there are some interesting themes that we can explore. But of course, before we do that, I gotta give a little bit of a recap. Okay, so punk band The Ain't Rights take a last-minute show while touring the Pacific Northwest, where the audience are mostly neo-Nazi skinheads. They decide to open their show with the Dead Kennedys classic Nazi Punks Fuck Off, but eventually the crowd seems to dig their set, even though they're initially kind of pissed off at them. Now, as they're packing up their van, getting ready to leave, Pat goes back to the green room to get Sam's phone. But when he enters the room, he sees a woman stabbed to death on the floor. He runs out of the room and attempts to call the cops, but then he and the band are snatched up, locked inside the green room by the bar employees. The band eventually get one of the employees, Big Justin's, gun from him and negotiate with Darcy, the leader of the pack, outside the door. He wants them to surrender, and they just want to get safe passage out. Pat, which is Anton Yelchin's character, eventually agrees, and when he goes to trade the gun, a bunch of skinheads start chopping at his arm, and they leave his hand just barely attached. The band then end up killing Big Justin, and they find a basement below the green room that they think they might be able to escape through. They end up finding out that it's used for heroin production, and there's really no way out from the basement, so they decide that the only way out is to go out through the main entrance of the green room door and fight their way out. Now, once they're out, an attack dog kills the singer, Tiger, and then Reese, the tough guy of the group, gets stabbed to death while he's climbing out of a window. So Amber, Pat, and Sam go back to the green room inside to hide. The three then explain to Daniel, one of the employees, that the skinheads actually killed his girlfriend, so he decides to help the three to try to escape, but he gets his head blown off by the bartender. Pat then kills the bartender, and then they grab the shotgun, but once they're outside, Sam is killed by the attack dog, so once again, Pat and Amber have to go back to the green room. The final plan is to lure the skinheads into the basement, get their guns so they can make their final escape and actually get out, and while Darcy and crew... Darcy is Patrick Stewart's character. They're planning this whole cover-up operation. Pat and Amber, they actually do get a hold of two guns, and they take Gabe, Macon Blair, hostage so they can escape. Then they let Gabe go so that he can go call the cops, and they trek through the woods where they end up finding Darcy by his home, and they kill him. The film ends with Pat and Amber sitting on the side of the road waiting for the cops.
What a movie!
All right, but before we continue, I gotta give a quick shout-out to our sponsor for this week's episode, Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of a million-plus royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. You know the deal. I use Storyblocks. We at Wisecrack use Storyblocks for our videos. If you need B-roll footage, if you need a song, if you need some sort of cool sound effect like a scream or a squish or a whoosh or whatever it might be, Storyblocks has access to all of this madness so that you can get it if you sign up for their all-access plan by going to storyblocks.com/wisecrack. That's storyblocks.com/wisecrack. Again, this is for all you creators out there. Don't worry about paying royalties or any of that other madness. Get that all-access plan, and you have all of the good content right at your fingertips with Storyblocks. Storyblocks.com/wisecrack, or click the link in the show notes. Now back to the show. All right, so we're going to jump into kind of peeling back some layers of this film. But before we do, we got to give a quick shout-out. We have a new freaking Twitter handle that is dedicated to our little corner of the podcast interwebs here. Go to smtm_pod, P-O-D. That's smtm_pod. Give us a follow. We'll be retweeting, tweeting, talking about other stuff that either comes up in the show or maybe stuff that doesn't come up in the show, giving you heads up on what we're going to discussing in upcoming episodes. So give us a quick follow, smtm_pod. Not like the new metal band, but as in pod. All right. this fucking film is not nu metal. This film is old school punk rock with a little bit of inflection of new school punk rock attitude. Ryan, what do you got to say about this film? What do we think about this film? What's we said energy, we said kind of immersion. What is something that you love about this movie?
Another thing, as you were talking, that reminded me of was that one scene that you brought up was the orchestral score, and it's just kind of beautiful, and you're watching everybody kind of in the moment, because I think that's a very important concept. It, you know, being in the moment. You know, these guys, like, they don't care. They're on the road. They're just scrapping every show to get by, you know, to get to the next place. And that's kind of the fun of being in a band. You're living in the moment, show to show. And it's just kind of like, this is the horror movie version of what could happen on the road and stuff. But I think that one minute to minute and a half sequence where the orchestra is playing while they're playing that song, you know, it really kind of is the foundation of the movie. Because it's like they've gotten to this point, they're these fishes out of water in this dark, scary place, but they're just living it up. They don't give a fuck, you know, like they play Nazi punks fuck off no matter the consequences. And then, of course, you know, we see what happens in the movie. But yeah, that's just kind of part of the ethos. And so I thought it was really cool how they set up their characters in the thing. And then also just being around punk houses and, you know, DIY venues and stuff. This movie feels really dirty, right? Because it's like they're in this shitty green room with these shit, you know, these shitty people. And then like the whole like box cutting with all them stabbing him in the arm with the box cutter. All the violence in this movie, which is super brutal and awesome and real looking to me, a real feeling. It's all not, it's like not just gratuitous for the sake of, you know, like a horror movie, but it's like, this is how a fucking, you know, person that is trying to cut off your arm, like, would stab you a bunch, right?
Yeah.
Like it feels gross. And then you don't, and then I think I even saw an interview with Saulnier who said, yeah, we didn't want to have any of these gratuitous cutaways to the bodies after they were dead. Once they were dead, they were dead. And that's just, you know, he moved on with the story. I thought that was an interesting, I'd never seen a movie do that like before in such an effective way, where you have these four main characters. And yeah, once that main singer, who we've been with the whole movie, gets attacked by that dog and dies.
Oh, fuck.
It's like he's an afterthought in the movie, kind of, after that, at that point. Afterthought's the wrong word, but like, we never see him again. We never see these gratuitous close-ups that you would see in a normal Hollywood movie, to be like, all right, this guy's dead, and this is what happened to him. Anyway, so those were just some thoughts that I had while you were talking about the movie.
Yeah. Raymond, what do you think, man? Any piggybacking off that?
Oh, man. I mean, there's so much to get into. With a movie like this that is so... I love movies that are just like fucking freight trains. Like, they just... They set the stage very clearly. You know who these characters are. You know what the predicament is. And then you just kind of follow that predicament until its natural conclusion. Or, you know, unnatural conclusion, or upsettingly unnatural conclusion, or... But one of the things kind of that you were talking about with regards to that opening sequence with, or not opening, but the sequence where the diegetic music drops out and they go into the score, and Jeremy Saulnier deploys what he claims is the first time he's ever used slow motion in his entire feature filmmaking career.
Three movies?
Yeah, at this point, this was his third feature. But it is still one of those things where, like, you know, people have a tendency to lean on these kind of storytelling conventions. And he said on the commentary for this that it was a choice for him that was like, you know, these people are going to be doing such monstrous and terrible things, but he wanted to actually show them in this sort of, like, human moment. And I think that there is, like you said, Ryan, there is kind of a key to that unlocks certain aspects of the movie. One of the things that I love so much about this film is that there's this kind of through line of this, of like competing narratives being told. That the most obvious example of which is the desert island bands, that they, when they're giving the interview at the beginning, and they all say like the band that they think a punk rock band should be, you know, most inspired by, they all say like the Misfits and the Dead Kennedys. I can't remember exactly. And then, of course, later on, when shit hits the fan, they're like, okay, let's just have a moment of honesty real quick. My team is Simon and Garfunkel, and they kind of go around and do it again. And I think there's something so great about that, that, like, not only that moment as a through line to humanize those characters, but you see how, like, the counter to that is that, like you said, when they go out and start the show with Nazi punks fuck off, they throw beer bottles at them and they spit at them and they give them the finger. And that is what the ain't-rights expect. And that is the limit of what the ain't-rights think is, like, physically possible to happen to them within this place. That there is still, like, a social contract that even, like, Nazis are bound by. And one of the most insane things in this movie is that they continue to believe the narratives that the Nazis are spinning for them in the same way that they're, like, kind of convincing themselves of their own narrative. Like, they have all these great scenes. For example, the one with Eric Edelstein, where they, the big guy with the gun, where they get him in the arm bar, which is such a great touch that, like, yeah, one of these members is just, like, a practitioner of MMA, and he does this to stay in shape or whatever, yeah. And he's, like, such a valuable asset in the corner. But the movie never, other than, like, when he puts the one guy up against the wall at the beginning at the Mexican restaurant, the movie never draws attention to that. It's not played like or whatever.
It's one little line. They just say, like, slow down, jiu-jitsu, or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's all they need to say. And then you know, oh, this is – and just his attitude. He's the tough guy, right? He always wants to start shit. And so you're like, okay, so this is the guy that trains. He works out. The rest of them aren't, you know. So
yeah, 100%. But yeah, they have this thing where they start, and Jeremy Sonia even calls attention to it in the commentary, where they start, like, playing detective, where they're like, okay, empty all the pockets, let's see if we can find a phone, empty his pockets to make sure that he doesn't have another weapon, okay, he's got a box cutter, and they don't think in the moment to check for him if he has a phone, and then it's too late by the time they find out that he does. And on the other side of the door, Darcy and all of the Nazis and stuff are building their own narratives, not only with the lies that they're telling the kids, but they're also basically, like, there is something interesting within this movie that, like, the bad guys have to know that they are the bad guys. Like, by the end of the movie, the guy who has the dogs is telling them, like, the attack command is Foss, and it's the only command that you'll need. Like, these people are hammers, and they acknowledge that the rest of the world is just nails. So much so that even when, like, they have to spin yarns to get themselves out of trouble, it's just a different form of violence that has been committed at their venue. It's like the police come up to investigate a stabbing, and they convince two twin skinheads to stab each other, like, playfully, because they understand.
That was awesome.
They understand what the ain't rights don't. The ain't rights think they're like hardcore because they get up and scream into microphones. And these guys are like, no, we know we're killers. We know what we're capable of. We know how we are perceived. And by owning that, they basically control the entire movie. You know, up to the point where, like, even by the end of it, another example of the way that they, like, turn the stabbing narrative. So, like, no, a stabbing did take place here, but it's a friendly stabbing. They spin the narrative at the end of the thing too, where it's like, we're not going to try and deny that we killed all these people. We're just going to create a narrative by which we had some sort of, like, moral justification, like they were trespassing and stealing our gasoline and stuff like that. And right. By, like, owning their evil. And that's one of the fucking great things about this movie. It is, like, pure, uncut, unadulterated evil that they are up against. They are able to control the narrative, like, both physically and, you know, in the story sense, throughout the entire movie. And it's just such a sharp piece of writing, I think, that, like, it kind of reminds me, I've been rewatching all the Tim Burton movies lately, and I recently rewatched Mars Attacks, and one of the best running gags in Mars Attacks is that all of the humans keep assuming that the Martians are acting in good faith, when it's, like, painfully transparent that, like, every single time they meet up with them, they get obliterated. And there's kind of a weird natural running thing in this where these kids start to, like, they keep they keep taking these Nazis at their word when Macon Blair says, like, just wait here and I'll be right back. And he comes back with a fucking gun. If they had just said, like, fuck that, we're not trusting a Nazi, and beat it out of the green room at that point, the movie could have been over. Like, they could have gotten away. And it's just one of those things where, like, these kids, they want to trust that, like, no matter what their differences are with these people, and they are multitudinous, like, I don't think any of the kids are white supremacists by any means, but they still trust that they are humans. And no, they're not up against humans. They're up against fucking evil. And I love how clear the movie is about that. Sorry for rambling.
That was a good fucking ramble. Now, hold on. I tried to take notes on this because there's a lot of shit to peel back here. But before we do, we've been getting some a little bit of shit talking in the chat that says that this isn't live. So I just want to say, guess what? By the very fact that I acknowledge that, Big Smoke, we're fucking live, man. This is fucking live. So if you want to come at us.
Oh, we are?
You can come.
This is in the future.
They're thinking this is pre-recorded, which means get involved in the freaking chat. So if you're in the chat, get involved in the chat. We are definitely monitoring the chat. So Big Smoke, you may have bailed on us because I think it said that you said you were going to bail. But we're putting you on blast right now. So everybody, if you want, we can drop little jokes about Big Smoke because now I'm throwing smoke at Big Smoke. So if Big Smoke ever comes back, we can remember that. No, I'm just kidding. Big Smoke, we love you. Come back. But yes, we are watching.
I also, real quick before you go on your next point, I'm also watching the chat, and there are also some folks who are chiming in and making jokes about how we are insulting their German culture. And to that I say, Nazi punks, fuck off. I know you're being ironic, but I think there's enough ironic hatred and racism on the internet already. So fuck off, Nazi punks.
Yeah, and here's the deal.
You're missing a lot.
Yeah, right. Your German heritage does not necessarily mean it's a Nazi heritage. I mean, look at me. I am German in heritage through and through. My dad is literally blonde-haired, blue-eyed. He's like fucking Hitler's Aryan fantasy, okay? The only reason I got brown eyes is because my mom has brown hair and brown eyes because of the French. But we are German, and guess what? I will still say, Nazi punks, fuck off, man. Come on. Dead Kennedy is in the house. Anyway, we love you. We are watching the live chat. Of course we're watching the live chat. Send us in your questions, your thoughts, what you think about this film. Interesting stuff, interesting themes, things like that. But there's so much stuff that just came up in the fucking discussion between what Ryan and Raymond were just saying. I just wanted to say, there's something really interesting, I think, about this distinction between, like, being in the moment and building narratives, right? So you got this DIY crew that they think that they're at, like, the margins of freedom, right? Like, they don't want to do anything digitally. They maybe want to, like, print, a 7-inch because analog's more real. It's kind of, like, more authentic and earthy and stuff like that. And they're at, like, the edge of this DIY punk ethic, which is super sick. But for them, that's freedom, right? And I like something that we might be able to kind of, like, contrast this with is for them, they think in terms of kind of, like, impulsive, like, being in the moment, being free, not necessarily having a plan, right? They keep running out of gas because they don't really have a good plan. Their show gets canceled. They don't have any money because they don't really have a plan. They're kind of just like in the moment, following the flying by the seat of their pants sort of thing. And I think that's through and through to what they're doing. They're not really trying to be institutionalized in any way. And maybe we could think of even as story or narrative as being a form of, like, structure and control and institutionalization, right? But then what happens is you contrast that with once they get put into this setting, and this setting is a story. It's a narrative, and it's a narrative of this kind of, like, neo-Nazi ethic, right? This ethic that is holding this community together, where they're selling drugs, where they're committing other crimes. They kill the one girl because her and her partner are going to be leaving the skinhead way of life, apparently. So they kill the one, right? So there's this community that is being held together by narrative. And then what happens? The first act of the band to try to get out of the green room is they kind of just say, fuck it, right? Which is them again doing their DIY, we're fucking anarchists, there is no narrative, let's just fucking get out. And then what happens? Well, the lead singer dies and the tough guy dies instantly, right? And so it's like, okay, well, that ethic doesn't work. And then they kind of come up with a little bit of a plan, but then Sam gets killed. And so then finally, what is it that saves them? They have to create their own narrative. And it's a kind of like a bullshit narrative where they play pretend, where Pat's character is like, yeah, this one time I went paintballing. And then the Amber character, like, he doesn't get to finish his story that he tells earlier about how they ended up, like, getting through this paintball slaughter by these guys who were, like, ex-Iraq, like, veterans or whatever that all kicked their ass in this this paintball competition. But then she says, you know, tell me the rest of your story. And then they come up with the plan, and the plan is the thing that saves them. So it's almost like they had to then have a structure. They had to have a narrative. They had to come together so that they could get out. And it had to be a competing structure, a competing narrative that would allow them to contest the other structure. Because if you just say, fuck it, you're not going to be able to adequately contest it. So that's what I was thinking. I was kind of thinking about like the difference. And I think that scene that Ryan and I were like highlighting, where it's like that orchestral balletic dance where they're in the fucking mosh pit and the music is playing, is that wonderful contradiction between those two. You've got the in the moment flow that looks like chaos, but it's also organized, right? So it's like, what do you do? How do you organize the impulsive power of punk rock that is just like, you know, tear down the establishment, say what you want, express yourself in your freedom, right? How do you compare that, or how do you control that and contain that in a way that's productive? Or is there a way that it can be productive and powerful? And I think that's one of the cool things that this film also maybe explores thematically. What do you think? Am I reading too much into it?
No, absolutely. I think by the end of the film, when they go into the sort of like, when they start playing war, so to speak, they throw them onto their back foot just enough that in the commentary, speaking of the paintball scene, Jeremy Saulnier talks about how that is based on a true story, that he and a friend of his went paintballing and they didn't have enough people to fill the entire course, so they got paired up with a team full of Marines who were just acing them. And then when they were like, well, they just expect us to fucking like cower back here and just try to like, you know, lean up and shoot every once in a while, what if we just run out there and see what they do, and will that throw them off just enough to get the upper hand, however briefly? And sure enough, they won a round by doing that. And that is like, it's such a cool little sequence at the end there, how like Imogen Poots is like, they're counting down the shells that he has in the shotgun, and she like dangles the one body down and he doesn't fall for it. And then Anton Yelchin distracts the guy again, and then she calls him back again and she's dangling a new body down, and that time he takes the bait. And it's just little things like that where it's like, okay, we're keeping track of the shotgun shells, and we're pretty sure that he's nervous playing monkey in the middle like this, so we're quite certain that maybe at the very least he's not keeping track of how many bodies we got up here. And it's just one of those things where like, it may be kind of a movie convention to be able to throw the decoy out there, but the fact that he doesn't take the bait on the first one, and she even reacts, she's like, oh, fuck. like, they just have to like reload with a different body and try it again. And if he doesn't take the bait with that last shotgun shell, it's just like, okay, I guess we just got to storm him. You know, one or the other of us, or maybe yeah. both will die. But this is like, all right, yeah. we're going to throw one more clay pigeon at it. I also love that the narrative convention for a movie like this would be, oh, once they find the basement, they would find an exit. And I love that it's a dead end. I love that it just becomes more universe building. And it's like, okay, well, now we just have, you know, four more corners to hide in. Like, there's this great
or four more corners to be trapped in, which is another important thing.
Sure, it's certainly.
Like, yeah, it's the claustrophobia. It's the no way out sort of thing. Ryan, someone in the chat, Big Boss, says, what did you guys think of the gore in the movie? What are your thoughts of the gore in this film? You said that it was realistic
it's very
before.
Effective.
Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of touched on it earlier, just how it was. It feels gross and dirty when it's happening. It's very effective, especially, you know, the slicing with the box cutter scene and all the like, and that they don't really hang on it for too long, so it's equally effective. That's what everyone says at the end of this movie, is that you like are shaken, and that you still feel this movie after it's over. And I think that his effective use of quick shots of, you know, the violence does that. But also, kind of what you were alluding to before, this movie very much feels like yeah, you're constantly revising your plan, and you're putting yourself in the situation, and it's just, you know, there's nothing supernatural or fantastic. It's like it's MacGyver stuff at the end, but with younger punk rock kids. So it's like a really funny, you know, you don't want to laugh because they're in this dire situation with these Nazis and stuff, but you are kind of like the whole time, you know, it's almost funny how helpless they are and how every little stupid plan that they have is kind of like, oh yeah, that maybe that's so stupid it actually might work, but you're probably going to get killed. And then people do. So,
well, yeah, the thing I love about it.
There's a weird, dark sense of humor to this movie.
Yeah, sure. The thing I love about it, too, is, like, I was thinking of Your Next when I was watching this. You remember how, like, shit's going crazy in Your Next, but then, of course, the woman who ends up kind of, like, saving the day is because she grew up in a survivalist camp, and so she's got, like, all these skills and shit like that. There's none of that in this. These are just ordinary people, and nobody really knows how to use a gun, and nobody really knows how to use a knife, and nobody really knows tactics and strategies and plans. And the thing I love about it is that, like, even when Imogen Poots at the end is holding the shotgun, you're like, okay, like this character does not shoot guns, right? The way she's holding the gun, it's not like she's got it like perfectly held and secured. The way that Anton Yelchin is holding the gun, you know, like also his arms all fucked
up. They're terrified of having that kind of weapon or power. You know, it's
And that's great because I feel like it adds to, I know this might sound cliche, but it's so important to linger over this. It adds to the realism of this because, I mean, if you take a group of people who are punk musicians who maybe, I mean, I'm just presuming here, but let's just presume they're probably not like hunting and they're probably not like guns rights activists. I don't know how often fucking Tiger and Pat and Sam go to the shooting range. Maybe the other character Reese, maybe he knows some tactical stuff, but he gets killed pretty quickly because he tries to go all fucking everyone for themselves sort of thing. But I don't think these are the type of people that would have trained much in how to use a weapon. And so then we see that, right? Like, we see when they open the door and Sam fucking just, she throws the fucking light bulb out there, you know,
hoping and it just hits the wall and falls in the empty hallway. It's such a great
so
beat.
It's like, it's like, you know, everyone has a good plan until they get punched in the mouth sort of thing, and they got fucking punched in the mouth and their plans, they don't work to what's actually in front of them, you know.
Yeah, you bring that aspect up, and that's one of the very, I think, very, very canny aspects of this film, and not only the filmmaking, but all credit to the performers. Anton Yelchin, phenomenal in this film, rest in peace. Mark Webber, who's also very good in the movie, I think a wonderful actor in his own right, when he is the character who comes in near the end and is, like, turning on the Nazis because his girlfriend was killed.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And when he comes
Daniel's
in at the end,
Daniel's a
character. Daniel,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So when he comes in, the movie starts treating him like the hero. The movie starts treating him like the guy, okay, he's on his turf. He knows these people. He knows what they're capable of. And he quite likely is capable of it as well. And it feels for a moment like the movie is treating him like he's going to be, even when they exit the green room flanked behind Mark Webber, the camera does kind of like the hero tilt up, starting at his feet and sort of like rising up, and he's walking out. I think he's got the machete in his hand or some such other weapon. And he's telling them like, oh, you know, I know where the shotgun is. It's right here under the bar. Walks over to the bar. And as he's looking for the shotgun, a round just blasts right through his head. And it's just another one of those great misdirects where like this movie is trading on your awareness of how these movies work. And they do it again with Anton Yelchin near the end of the movie, where he's fucking made up like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando. He's got you know, the Sharpie camo war paint on, and he's got a gun, and he's not playing a hero. He's trying to play a hero. He's a frightened child who's trying to play an action star. And there's this wonderful moment where he's pointing the gun through the windows of the van. And when he starts to circle around the van, he's got the gun outstretched, and the sleeve of his jacket snags on the side mirror. And it's just one of those things where Jeremy Sonnier said it happened on accident in one take, and then he had Anton Yelchin do it on purpose every other take after that, because it's just one of those things of like, yeah, you're not someone with great, like, you know, spatial awareness. You're not like running down the math in your head of like how to operate on a battlefield. You're trying to scare this guy more than you yourself are scared, and you're just not paying attention to other things like getting in your fucking way. And it is one of those things that is like representative of a certain degree of trauma. Like if you talk to people who have been in like firefights or who have served in war zones, they talk about how like the world goes dark around it, and how like you just like you can just sort of zero in on things and stuff like that. And it's just a very sharp bit of writing and a wonderful, wonderful piece of acting from the cast all around.
Yeah, damn straight. Ryan, any further thoughts here on these things that we've been discussing?
Yeah, like, to me this, I was just thinking about it while Raven was talking, like the, you know, that part of the hero's story circle, whatever, the hero's journey, where it's like, you are in over your head, and you have to figure out how to get out over your head. Like, that, this movie is like that beat for the whole film, I feel like, where it's like, these kids are so far over their head, and you know, that's like we were kind of talking about before, it's almost comedic in a sense. And also what you were talking about before, Raymond, about how evil these people are. I mean, yeah, it's like, it's kind of like you don't know, you know, whatever that quote is in life, like you don't know what you don't know until whatever. Or I think you actually just said it even more perfectly with the cliche of, you know, you don't, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. It's like, yeah, when you're a kid, you feel like you know it all, and like, yeah, that you can just step up to this, you know, this bully and say, Nazi punks, fuck off, and that, like you guys say, like what's the worst that's going to happen? They're going to throw me out of this club. And it's like, no, there are people that are way more, you know, have way more worse intentions than you could ever imagine out there, and you got to be aware of that. And this is the horror story of that scenario. So yeah, this is a tragic movie.
It is a fucking tragic movie. What do we think of the end bit where they're constantly talking about their desert island? Like, what's the importance of the desert island album or band, right? Like, at first, is it that they're trying to be super, like, true to their roots, where, you know, they're sitting in the interview with the guy and he's saying, what's your desert island band? And they're all like naming these kind of independent or these authentic punk bands to be like, or like influences of punk bands, right? That, or, you know, someone mentions Black Sabbath, right? And so it's like, there's that. And then once they're in that scary situation, then they start kind of like saying actually what their real desert island band is. And it's a little bit more like pop type of albums or pop type of music. And then at the very end, when Anton Yelchin and Imogen Poots are sitting there, the Pat and Amber characters, you know, he says, I think I know what my one is. I know what my desert island band is, after not being able to say what it was in both scenarios before. He just couldn't figure it out. And now he finally gets it. And she looks at him and she says, tell someone who gives a shit. So, like, what is going on there? There's no salvation? Is that kind of the idea? Like, is that why this is a tragic film? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, there's nothing.
I think,
like, yeah, go ahead.
There is a notion that, like, for all of the Ain't Rights kind of, like, protestations at, like, social media and going digital and wanting to do things the real way, because that to them is more authentic, there still is this kind of suggestion that that notion of authenticity, that kind of curated authenticity, is still something of an affect in and of itself. Like, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if you do everything the hard way, the punk way, the way that they are doing it, it, like, the notion is that that makes it more authentic. But if it's if it's disingenuous and if it's all an affect, then, like, what are you really accomplishing? And I think that's what he's underscoring with the Desert Island picks, is, like, they go on that radio show and they want to prove their punk bona fides, so they say all the, you know, all the stock answers from the characters that they are playing within that interview, the characters that they play on stage. And this, like, by the end of the movie, their characters have been stripped away. This comes to that thing I was saying before, where, like, these characters projecting the notions of themselves in these, like, spaces in which they circulate, once again, they can't imagine any greater conflict than, like, we got to siphon some gas. We got to, like, their idea of living like outlaws is stealing some gas from the ice rink and, you know, getting beer bottles thrown at them at some Nazi punk roadhouse. But they can't possibly imagine the notion that they aren't immortal. They can't possibly imagine the notion that, like, their circle is only 1 degree away from pure fucking evil. And by the end of the movie, when he's like, oh yeah, I know what my desert island band is, and Imogen Poots says, like, who gives a fuck? It is just that notion of, like, you have to let go of whatever idea of you were curating. Like, this is who you are now. I this is something maybe a little bit, not necessarily personal, but it's kind of sensitive subject matter. But I was interviewing folks a while back for a project that I was working on, folks who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I have, you know, a complicated history with the military myself, but I remember talking to one person who was a sniper overseas, and he was saying, like, you know, there are three things in my life that I think of, like, every single time when I wake up. I'm a husband, I'm a father, and I'm a murderer. And most people don't say that third one ever. And it's difficult for me to process that. It's difficult for me to work through that. And we can, like, I don't want to get off on a tangent about the implications of that and what he was driven to do or what he was made to do, whatever. But the thing that Anton Yelchin has arrived at is that he is no longer the guitarist in a punk band. He's a killer. Like, that's something that he is going to carry with him, whether or not it was justified, whether or not it was in self-defense. But he is going to have to carry that trauma with him for the rest of his life. And that is now the thing that defines him. And there is no amount of, like, self-mythology that is going to be able to change what he has experienced in this one moment.
Right. Well, in psychoanalysis, the important thing is it's not that you reconcile all the contradictions in your life. It's that you become reconciled to the contradictions in your life. And I think one of the things that this film is exploring is this contradiction between the sort of, like, I that we express and then the I that we tell ourselves that we are, maybe in the form of, like, an ego or a self or something like that. And this is why, like, I'm a real big fan of narrative therapy, you know? Like, my therapist is, that's her specialty, is narrative therapy. And for me, one of the things I really love about it is it's precisely that. It's exploring, like, what are the stories that we tell about ourselves? What are the stories that we have been told about ourselves that we're like, yes, that's who I am, and that's who I'm not, and all these other things. And when you start kind of exploring things from a narratival perspective, you really start to deal with that contradiction between the, oh, this is the self that I feel like I am versus this is the self that I'm telling myself that I am and how I'm going to live my life. And it's an interesting place of, like, productive contradiction that you can really work through. And I think that's kind of what I was getting at earlier when Ryan was talking about, like, being in the moment. There's, like, when you're in the moment, there is no self, right? It's like that flow state idea that you oftentimes hear popularized today, or we call it the zone, right? Or what did they call it in the movie Soul? Was it the zone? Like, when you're in the zone, right? You get into the zone, right?
Yeah,
you're like in that. The flow, right? It's almost unconscious. You're just in the grooves of the flows of this world of flux and chaos. And then, of course, there's, like, structure in the narrative. I am a this and I am a that. And then that's where, like, you know, this is going to sound fucking crazy, but the basketball player Giannis Antetokounmpo, he basically said one of the most profound things I've ever heard in my entire life, and I'm going to keep talking about this until the day that I die, but all credit to Giannis. Someone asked him before they won the championship, they were like, you know, how do you stay, like, on top of things? And he said, when I'm focused on the past, he's like, when I say I did this and I did that, or we accomplished this or we accomplished that, he's like, that's my ego, right? He's like, and then when I'm too focused on the future, like, I'm gonna do this and we're gonna do that and these are the things I'm gonna take care of, he's like, that's my pride. He said, but when I'm focused in the moment, in the present, where there's no expectations and I'm just kind of in the flow, he said, that's humility. And he said, that's what I try to do. And I literally, I was like, whoa! I was like, this is, like, the most profound thing I have heard in so long. And it came out of the voice of an athlete who usually they just, like, reproduce talking points that they're told by their teams, right? To just say.
World, you know? Champion, man.
And now he's a fucking world champion.
I think you tweeted a link to that video.
I remember watching that.
I think I got it from your Twitter.
Yeah, it's on my Twitter. It's so fucking cool. But I think that's one of the things that this film explores is the difference between, like, those structures of the future that we tell ourselves that we're gonna do, and then the past that we're stuck in. And, you know, in psychology, they often talk about when you're attached to the past, that's what kind of leads towards depression a lot of times. And then when you are stuck with the uncertainty of the future, that's what produces anxiety. And so it's kind of like living within those contradictions of past and future that oftentimes can produce these twin poles of depression and anxiety, right? And things like that. So I think this film kind of deals with those things a lot, like not depression and anxiety from a personal perspective, but more from, like, a structural perspective, like the anxiety of how to deal with who you are and what you are in those situations. Real quick, before we kind of move on to another point, I just want to go to the chat real quick. Jake brings up a really interesting point, and I want to ask if you agree, disagree, what you think about this. Jake Lang says, I think that this film, not completely but in part, is within a recent movement of films which could be called aesthetic, that is, a very well-done piece of art whose whole purpose is to elicit its emotive and visceral reactions in the viewers more than to assert a concise thesis. And then he kind of later tried to clarify, say, I might more say art for art's sake. I think that has a better connotation. I do love this film, by the way. I hope the first comment didn't indicate otherwise. Yeah, I kind of got what you were saying. What do you think? Is this kind of an aesthetic film, like more form over substance or form over content? that is trying to elicit more of a response rather than present a concise thesis. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that the just subtle, kind of almost ambiguous and loose-ended nature of yeah, why does this movie exist? Why did you choose to tell the story in this way and kind of treat your characters so nonchalantly when they, you know, when brutal things are happening to them? I mean, I think those are fair questions to ask, why you would make all those pretty strong choices, because it leaves, I mean, I've never seen a movie like this that kind of moves in the way that it does. So I kind of halfway agree with you. Also, to piggyback on what you were saying earlier, like about the pressures we have and whatever, like I think the whole, I think that him picking a punk band was such a perfect vehicle for that discussion, because you know that's kind of the whole cliche conversation, tired conversation, is what is punk rock? Are you truly punk rock? You know, what does it mean to be punk rock? Like, and it's honest, even having the conversation is stupid and cliche and means you're not punk rock or what, you know? So a bunch of, a lot of times when you get to the core of it, what is it being punk rock? You know, it's obviously going against the grain and the status quo and mainstream or whatever. But also it's not being all, not using your time here on earth to, and caring about, you know, oh, just going through your 9-to-5 and whatever. It's like part of it is living in the moment and fucking getting hammered, doing drugs, sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of thing. And, you know, going to hardcore punk shows. So like I think that them using that scene and subculture to kind of, and putting it into this brutal world was just a really cool mix for a movie.
Yeah, there's the one bit too.
An aesthetic movie.
Yeah, and there's the one bit, speaking more about the aesthetics, where Reese, you know, Joe Cole's character, says something like, you know, he's mocking the guy that has the mohawk by saying, like, did he put, like, jizz in his hair or something like that, right? So right, even then, right, there's, like, this tension within the punk community about what punk is. Like, do you have to wear chains, and do you have to wear, like, a denim jacket that's got holes in it, that's got patches on it? Do you wear a mohawk, liberty spikes, or do you kind of like Joe Cole's character Reese just kind of looks like a middle class suburban dude, right? He's nice looking and he's clean cut and he works out and you know, he trains in mixed martial arts, and so like he's kind of just like a dude, whereas, you know, there's other people in the punk community that have a different aesthetic, that have a different sort of ethic about them, that carry themselves in different ways, you know. And so that's a nice kind of interesting tension as well, like what is punk and how do you express that punk attitude, so to speak, right? What do you think, Raymond?
Well, it also asks the question of, if punk is this sort of aspect of the counterculture, or it's meant to rebuke the system, how do you define yourself within that space or that counterculture or that niche when that aesthetic and that worldview is being co-opted by a worldview that you find abhorrent? And like, how do you, if you identify so closely with this world, like, how do you reconcile the fact that you find yourself, like I mentioned before, they're like only one degree away from this, you know, they have this really great reception from Tad, who welcomes them into his home. And there's this, you know, this great scene where they're just kind of snooping around and we're getting to know the character through the camera. And that guy who's so nice and welcoming and accommodating is like, oh yeah, you know, my cousin, he hangs out in this in this sort of area of Oregon. I don't necessarily know if you guys want to go play there, but I can probably hook you up with a gig if you want.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, I mean, we trust this guy. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And he even tells him, like, I'm going to be honest with you, it's pretty right wing. And they're just like, once again, it feeds into this narrative in their head that, like, well, you know, punk is punk and they're going to live and let live. And, you know, we can just ignore the Confederate flag on the wall or whatever. Hmm. And there is that, there's this amazing moment where they trip the breaker in order to get everyone to leave so that they can dispose of the ain't rights without, like, the audience there. And when Patrick Stewart comes out to tell everyone, like, "Oh, we tripped our main. We're gonna have to. We'll do another show later, and I'll refund cover charges." And then he says, I can't even remember what the line is, but he says something like, "And don't forget, there's a bake sale over the week." Like, there's some weird, there's some weird addendum on their way out where he's like, "And sign up for the call tree or something like
yeah,
that."
Yeah, because he says something like, "Remember, this is more than a something. It's a movement." Right.
Yeah, he says this isn't a party, it's a movement. But I think before that he, and maybe I'm just imagining it because it's just the sort of like casual nature of how he's sending them off is just like, "Oh, and don't forget," it reminds me of in The Nutty Professor with Eddie Murphy when he's like, "Oh, by the way, pop quiz on Tuesday," like as everyone's like walking out of the classroom. And it's just this sort of like bizarre energy within this space that's like this once again is not necessarily, to bring it back to your question about like what constitutes the punk ethos and the punk identity, you get the sense that the fucking Nazis may not even necessarily be into this. It may just match their aesthetic, that they like music that goes fucking hard, and the whole punk thing is essentially just an excuse for them to congregate and for them to plot and scheme and exchange all their fucking bile. But I mean, like, the punk thing for them is quite literally a cover in the movie. The real thing that's going on is they're selling heroin out of the basement. So it is this thing of like, when punk has been so co-opted and bastardized by so many different types of people, so many different like niche cultures, it becomes a question of like, do any of these identify with like the core ethos, like the anti-fascist ethos of punk? Obviously not some of these characters. But are they all just essentially using it as a part of an aesthetic? Is it just an affect for everyone so that their true nature can fly under the radar, be that for good or ill?
All right, we could keep fucking talking about this movie. Let's just do one final thing, and then we'll jump into the mailbag real quickly. Ryan, do you have a favorite part, a favorite sequence, a favorite visual, a favorite moment, or just a favorite thing about this film? The one favorite thing. When someone says green room, what do you want to just like burst out and be like, "Oh my God, you got to see this"?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I mean, I don't do that, but I always think about fucking Anton Yelchin getting his arm stabbed.
Great prosthetic.
Is what I think about.
Great prosthetic work.
Yeah,
in this
movie. So that, you know, fucked me up.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to ask me what my island punk band
is. Okay, then let's do it. What's your island? What's your island? What's your island band? Come on. Desert Island.
I mean, like, a Desert Island punk band. Like, I'm going to have to go. I'm going to go a little deeper cut. I'm going to go Butthole Surfers.
I know shit.
They're a little more post-punk rock, you know what I mean? Or whatever the fuck you want to call it. But Butthole Surfers is where it's at for me, you know. And what about you, motherfucker?
Well, so I grew up in Southern California where it was skate punk all the way. So if I'm going to go like punk, Desert Island punk band, I'm going to go Pennywise. We used to go to Pennywise concerts all the time. Like, one of my best friends was cousins with the bass player, Randy, the bass player from Pennywise. So we used to go all the time. So I'm going to fucking go Pennywise. My first concert that I ever went to when I was 16, like real concert, I'd been to other concerts, but my first concert by myself with my friend, it was Blink-182, Unwritten Law, and a band called Phoenix TX. They used to be called River Phoenix, but then they had to change their name. Yeah, Phoenix TX. Yeah, yeah. And so that was like the first show. So that was like the music that I grew up in. And then more on the skate punk side, it was, you know, Assorted Jelly Beans, NOFX, like I said, Pennywise. Like, and then of course, then
Assorted Jelly Beans. Yeah, hell fucking yeah.
Assorted Jelly Beans, man. So it wasn't until I got older that I really got into like more old school kind of like, you know, Descendants, Dead Kennedys, Suicidal Tendencies, stuff like that, which I still love them. But if I'm going to be on a desert island, I want like something more melodic. So I'm going to go Pennywise. And actually the weird thing is people are going to hate me for this. I love Jim, the singer from Pennywise, but my favorite Pennywise album is actually when Zoli came over and he did the album with them. Yeah. And so his voice, cause I just forgot the name of the band that he is the lead singer of. They're also amazing. Oh, it just went out of my head. But his voice to me is amazing. Like I said, I love Jim, but that album is like one of my favorite punk albums ever. So I would just say Pennywise, but yeah. All right.
Okay.
Raymond?
Screeching Weasel would be my number two. Sorry. Yeah, go Raymond.
I'm fairly eclectic. I like a lot of music, but I'm not as hardcore into punk as you guys seem to be. I think as close to punk as I get, and I guess they're punk in their day in a certain way, although their sound evolved a lot. But as far as like my favorite bands go, the closest to punk I get is The Clash. I love The Clash.
Yeah.
And okay. Outside of the punk world, being a, you know, a good small town Ohio boy, I'll probably catch heat for this, but I grew up, not necessarily grew up, but when I was in high school was when the Black Keys were really hitting hard.
They're legit.
Their sound has changed quite a bit now. You know, be that as it may, I still really enjoy their music, and a lot of their early albums I love to death. That was one of my favorite bands in high school. And one more thing I will say about the movie Green Room is I just have to acknowledge the second to last shot, which to me is actually the last shot where the dog trots back to his owner and lays down to die.
Yes, yes.
A really beautiful moment. In my mind, that is the end of the movie. And that to me just, it puts a perfect encapsulation on, you know, we've talked about, is this style over substance? I don't think it is. I think there's a whole lot under the hood with this movie. And to me, the dog is a perfect representative of like, of violent racist extremism, that this sort of stuff can be ingrained into people. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are bad or inhuman. It just means that they have been broken in the wrong ways. And I think that dog is the ultimate symbol of that. It is the movie's conceit that this dog has been bred to hate. It wasn't born with hate in its heart. And I think, you know, that brings us full circle to that moment near the beginning of the film where all these people are dancing in this really beautiful transcendent way. And it's like, yeah, but to begin like untangling hate and deprogramming hate, we first have to understand it as a human emotion. And I think that's what this movie is very, very smart about. I love, love, love Green Room.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say too, just to kind of like add to that, I think this really fits with what we've been talking about, the difference between being in the moment, let's say the natural, the kind of purely impulsive, you know, maybe the instinctual, and the narrative and the story we tell. This fighting dog is only violent. Its instincts are only geared towards the violence to kill when it's operating under a particular story, a narrative, and a structure that is kind of forcing it to do the dastardly deeds, right? But when it's freed from that, it actually loves, and it goes over and it lays its head on this kind of like bad guy's arms, right? So there's something also about, you know, the kind of like simplicity and beauty of nature and the instinctual and the thing that seems violent that is kind of hidden by the stories that we tell, right? So I think that is kind of lovely. Yeah, Ryan, go ahead.
I know we're kind of here at the end though. Yeah. I mean, like to me, all these things we're talking about, you know, the Nazis basically being these symbols and stuff, I think it's pertinent. But I do wish that if they were going to delve more into, you know, what makes a white nationalist, which I think it's good that they didn't. They just kind of left that a little more open. But, like, I do think, like I think when you watch this movie, you don't really understand, you know, their philosophy or ideology. You're just supposed to, you know, you go Nazi bad, they suck, so, and we're moving on. You know, but like, yeah, like there's a version of this movie where, you know, and I feel like it's been made to American History X, gets into this and stuff about, you know, like the true psychology of a white nationalist and what that means. But yeah, it would have been interesting for, you know, another version of this where they would actually delve into that. What do you think?
This movie is kind of like dovetailing off of one of my other favorite movies and one of my favorite John Carpenter films, Assault on Precinct 13. And similar to what you're saying, Ryan, in Assault on Precinct 13, because that is itself kind of a riff on Rio Bravo. John Carpenter is kind of like treating the gang, and he's like, the gang is written and photographed the way that old movies, like, this is a dicey political thing, but really old westerns like Rio Bravo paint Native Americans as an uncomplicated evil. Obviously, that is a very racist way to depict Native Americans, but that's the fact of how they were portrayed in a lot of old westerns. Assault on Precinct 13 does the same thing with the fucking gang, where it's like, they're just this relentless force of evil. And then in Green Room, you're right. They don't like dig into like, what is the animating philosophy of these people? You kind of come into the movie understanding like, yeah, I don't think good guys really deck out their fucking nightclubs with all this shit. Like, I don't think good guys wear fucking SS patches on their jacket. Like, at a certain point, it recalls that Mitchell and Webb look sketch where they, you know, it's a very famous sketch where they turn to each other and they say, you know, are we the baddies? And it's like, yeah, you're wearing fucking skulls on your hat. Like, and that, like, that comes back to what I was saying before. Like, this is they are presented as human, but it is still very uncomplicated in its depiction of evil. Like, these folks know that they're not doing the right thing by, like, well, I guess to clean up this mess, we've got to, like, force two of our friends to stab each other, murder a handful of kids, and maybe sacrifice a handful of dogs. Like, there's no good thing that ends with this kind of fucking bloodbath. And I think the movie's very, very smart about how it presents them in that light, Ryan.
I think that the last thing that I'll say, and we're not going to be able to get into the mailbag this time, but I'll give a quick shout out on how you can contact us. But the last thing I'll say is that it is a really great discussion. And this gets us right into, like, the philosophy of art is, when something is style over substance, we might say, is there actually substance in the style, right? And vice versa, is there style in the substance? And are they really as separated as we tend to think? When something is aesthetic, it has to use certain aesthetics that carry with them implicit meanings. So, like Ryan just brought up, this idea that you have, you know, these caricatured individuals that we just automatically know, okay, neo-Nazi boots and braces, skinheads, far right equals the bad guys. It's because all of that meaning has already been kind of inherited, if you will, through the aesthetic. So then when you have certain types of music and sound and pace and all these things, do those things also carry with them subtle meanings that we're not being smacked in the face with? And maybe that's when art is really good. In my perspective, that's when I love art. When it doesn't preach at you, when it doesn't lead to so much with the thesis and say, this is the thesis that I'm trying to give to you, because then it becomes a little too preachy. But rather when it says, no, here's an expression of stuff. And then all those other meanings, I'm going to let three white dudes on a podcast talk about it for an hour and figure out what the fuck they can pull from that meaning. Also, white dudes with beards. Hold on. But Ryan, your beard is looking a little less beardy at the moment. I'm kind of... What's up, dude? You got to grow...
Yeah, well...
Yeah.
It doesn't grow well.
No, I love your beard, bro. Come on.
It's patchy, baby.
Yeah, fucking let that shit grow. Anyway, listen, if you want to contribute out there, if you're listening to us, you can call us and you can leave us a voicemail at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. You can also email us, movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. We didn't have time to get into the mailbag this week, but that's just because this movie is so freaking amazing and there's so much we could talk about. Obviously, as it is now, I'm even like forcing a cutoff so that we can get out of here, because I think we could probably keep chatting about it. But we gotta run. So as we sign off, where can people find you on the internet, Raymond?
Yeah, you can find me as always over on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. And yeah, like we said before, now you can find us all maybe at SMTM_pod. So check us out there on Twitter as well.
Yeah, Ryan.
Ryan Shorts on YouTube, Facebook, all that stuff. I'd also like to give a shout out to Lalo Dagach in the chat. Says the Cramps are in fact the best punk band. I cannot argue with you there, Lalo. The Cramps. So
and shout out to David Nicholson, who said in two sentences what we took an hour to do. Not all people are monsters, but all monsters are people. Fun world.
Yeah. And then let me just, for people out there that want to know another good punk band, X. If you don't know X, they were an LA punk band from the 80s. Freaking fantastic. Check out X. Also the Germs. I mean, there's so many. But X, if we're going to be on this. That was my dad's favorite punk band growing up, so that was like one of the first groups that I listened to. Anyway, I'm Austin Hayden. You can find me out there on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, Insta, AUS_HAY. We gotta get out of here. Ryan, send us out, brother.
Show me the meaning. We show you the meaning of the green room. Yeah, show me the meaning. Jackson, Jerry Maguire, Barry Quinn, Sean Duff, show me the money! That's it.